Hi listeners, Jason here. We are excited to finally announce registrations for the biggest psych health and safety community event ever. The inaugural The Psych Health and Safety Conference will be held at the Sofitel Wentworth Sydney, June 19 to 20, 2024, and offer concurrent virtual attendance. It'll feature live podcast recordings with OG researchers including Christina Maslach and Michael Leiter of Burnout fame, Psych Health and Safety USA podcast host I. David Daniels, Australian super experts including the likes of David Burrows, a special 10-year anniversary integrated approaches to workplace mental health panel with authors Tony LaMontagna, Angela Martin and Kat Page, handpicked case studies from organisations doing it well, and a very special interview with plaintiff Zaggy Kozarov by Catherine Dunlop on that High Court case which we previously covered on the podcast. This event will sell out. Get in quick to secure tickets at early bird prices for the two-day conference, pre-conference masterclasses, and the VIP dinner. The first 200 in-person registrations also get a copy of her latest book, The Burnout Challenge, signed by Christina Maslach herself. Find out more and register at www.psychhealthandsafetyconference.com. Now, on to this episode.
Communities ask a lot of the faculty, staff, and administrators of our K-12 education systems. However, our entire education system could be threatened if these folks don't feel safe at work. We'll talk with an emergency preparedness professional who uses a trauma-informed approach to crisis management in schools. Up next on this episode of the Psych Health and Safety USA podcast.
From Flourish DX, this is the Psych Health and Safety USA podcast. As workplace mental health has become a global priority, there's a greater focus on addressing psychosocial hazards. Each episode, we look at psychological safety from an occupational health and safety perspective. Let's talk Psych Health and Safety.
Welcome to this week's Psych Health and Safety USA podcast. I'm your host, Dr. I. David Daniels, and I want to thank you for tuning in. Each week, we seek to increase awareness of the importance of psychological health and safety by learning from the lived experiences, research, and expertise of our guests, as well as advocating strategies to reduce harm and minimize vulnerability to psychosocial hazards in the American workplace. So, according to a 2023 survey, a group by the name of Edweek Research Center suggests that 66% of teachers feel safe at work, which is lower than the 83% of principals and 88% of district leaders who feel safe. Additionally, 46% of teachers who responded to the survey said their sense of safety has decreased since 2019, compared to, again, 36% of principals and 26% of district leaders. So some of the factors that help teachers feel safe include secure physical space, discretionary alarms, training, mental health support, emotional intelligence, respectful communication, teacher autonomy. These are all areas or things that cause people to feel safe as they're operating in the educational systems in this country. Also, emergency management at schools is sometimes called crisis management. That's something else that teachers really have to be concerned about, particularly in the last 25 years since we've, you know, become more aware and certainly seen more issues of violence, a lack of preparedness on the part of our education systems. So we have the opportunity in this episode to chat with someone who is an emergency management professional, but also has become a bit more aware and starting to integrate how people feel their, you know, their psychological health and safety into that conversation around emergency management. And we had opportunity to, you know, to meet maybe a year or so ago, and I thought it'd be a really good voice to tie these topics together. So let's get to it with this. I guess it's not really a patented question. It's just the one that I use. It helps me get an introduction of my guest by my guest with this question. Who is Daniel Krause?
Well, I'm a naturalized American citizen. I was born in Chile, and my parents moved here when I was a young kid, and went to Oregon State University. I became a commissioned officer in the Marine Corps. I spent a little more than 5 years on active duty in the Marine Corps. And then I became a police officer, and I retired about 4 years ago, retired as a detective sergeant. And since then, I've been working in emergency management. I have a small consultancy where I do emergency management for a variety of organizations, but my focus has been on schools. And till recently, I was working part of a federal grant, and we're still in a transition between federal funding and what may be state funding. But it's been extraordinary to go to a new industry, have to learn new approaches. I've always loved emergency management. I was on the dive team for a while, working with firefighters, and learned to love ICS through that program. And anyway, I just love I love the advantage that it gives you to have effective incident command, have good plans. Having been an infantry officer in the Marine Corps, you can imagine planning is something you learn to appreciate. And that's what I do. And I just when I get feedback from a crisis that a school has gone through, and they say, you know, what we did was effective, it's really extremely rewarding.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we'll have an opportunity to dig into some of those topics. But before we do that, one more of my standard question. I only have two that are really standard. That I'd like to know what you think about the concept of psychological health and safety. When you hear that, what does that mean to you?
Well, I've really I've learned it from you, because I was sitting in a classroom, and there's this guy coming to talk to us with our one of our managers, and I had no idea, honestly, at that point what that meant. And when you started talking about it, it resonated with me. It just made sense that it was kind of the glue that binds these things that we do. I have a significant background in, obviously, as law enforcement, with security, and with emergency management, and with both physical security and organizational processes that we use. Integrating that, because it's kind of a DNA strand, if you will, because sometimes security is real, and sometimes you're just going through the motions, and figuring that out it's complicated. And I think in those times where we're playing security rather than really creating security or really creating safety, that failure to do it for real is a source of this cognitive dissonance, and that cognitive dissonance leads to a loss of psychological safety. And so I just view it as being this kind of this glue that within the organization, because we don't do emergency management or security or any of these things in a vacuum. We do them as to protect our workforce. In education, we do it to protect the students. If we understand a context for the decisions we make, and the way we communicate with our employees, I think it just makes a really big difference in how we some of the decisions that we make.
Right. Well, certainly your background in law enforcement are certainly probably clearer than most of us about this perception of safety, and the perception of security drives everything. People make decisions every single day about where they're going to live, where they shop, the people that they hang out with. And it is not about a set of facts. It's about a perception about the facts. You can have a police officer in every corner. You can have gates and barriers and alarms and all of that. And those are all activities, but not all of those activities cause people to feel any safer. As a matter of fact, sometimes the more of the visible kinds of things around security that people see, they actually feel less safe because of what they see. And, you know, again, to the point, it's really important about how people feel about these things, because we can do a lot of, you know, invest a lot of time, a lot of effort around, you know, all kinds of stuff. But if we don't connect with the people, we don't really know whether it's even working or not. We know we've got a lot of effort into it. We just don't know whether it works, you know. So chat a little bit about how you got interested in, so again, career law enforcement. What is it that got you interested, whether it be before or after you retired or whatever? What got you into emergency preparedness?
Like I said, I got exposed to incident command being around firefighters. Your origin story, right, includes firefighting. And I always joke that firefighters, when they go buy lunch, you know, you got an incident commander, you got an ops chief, and you got a finance person too. And so they always are applying incident command. In law enforcement has something of a reluctance to adopt incident command. But I began seeing when we were using some emergency management principles that we had better results. And I also participated in the county's emergency operations center, which is kind of the bigger picture, working with our disaster management. And so I had a boss in the Marine Corps who told me, if you fail to plan to fail. I think it's a Ben Franklin quote, I think. I didn't know until recently. If you plan, and particularly within emergency management, this notion of the before, the during, and the after, that we have plans for how to mitigate and prepare for an event, that we know how to respond to it, which is where we spend way too much time in that response. And then the recovery phase. And I use that for almost all of my conversations that I have with schools. And we do some things well, at least here on the West Coast. We have these psychological flight teams that are responding to things. But in many cases, there's like a divorce between facilities and the mental health people, and leadership isn't really sure of where they fit in. And so recovery is a major issue. I recently had something of a disagreement with one of my counterparts that does this same work. And he was saying, well, you know, if we can, I want to do prevention because I don't want to think of it as mitigation. I don't want to think about mitigation as much because I think we can completely prevent it. And my point was, you almost never can actually prevent something, in the sense of, if you prevent, say, an act of violence, which is kind of like worst case scenario in people's minds, even if you prevent the event from happening, you're still going to have impacts on your workforce. You're going to have, you may have people that are psychologically impacted directly as victims. There's never really, I mean, we don't actually prevent things from happening because you've already had your systems begin to operate to, which you are protecting your workforce and you are protecting your student body, mm-hmm. but you still have consequences.
Right. Right. Yeah. When I hear your description, it makes me think that, perhaps you can prevent one thing, you just can't prevent everything. So you may prevent that act of someone doing the thing you don't want them to do, you know, bringing the baseball bat and hitting somebody or whatever it is, you know, or you may prevent that, but you cannot prevent everything. And a lot of this has to do with recognizing the hazard environment, because I was chatting with somebody the other day about the fact there is no such thing as a hazard-free environment. There isn't. There may be more or less of a particular hazard, but you can't eliminate hazards, period. You can't eliminate the fact that, you know, Mother Nature is a force to herself. I mean, it can't be controlled. You can't prevent a hurricane. You can't prevent an earthquake. It might not happen all that often, but you can't prevent it when it's just going to happen. And then you, as you talked about, you get into the response phase and recovery and such. But, you know, I at least my view is that, you know, sometimes people want to have these binary choices for really complicated problems. It's either this or that. No, it's probably got to be a little bit of both of them. I mean, it's got to be a little bit of both. And it's this constant cycle of always kind of paying attention, which is why folks, you know, again, emergency managers will always have something to do. always. Because you're always, you know, preventing, preparing, mitigating, responding, or recovering from something. All the time. It just depends where on the wheel you are. So you've elected to apply your craft, and we may get a chance to talk about some of the other areas where you do emergency management. But so the school setting, I think that's an interesting place to do emergency management related stuff. So, you know, so talk about how that is similar or different to the other places where you've had the opportunity to do emergency management activities.
Well, I think the biggest difference, of course, is that you have this, you know, if FEMA talks about the whole community, well, we kind of plagiarize that and call it the whole school community. And so you have a workforce, which is pretty complex, actually, in a the bigger the district, the more complex the workforce is. Then you have a student body, which has no other industry has that issue that you have this extremely vulnerable, right? Like they're entrusted to you, they're almost like your customers. Maybe their parents are your customers, and the parents are part of that whole school community. And then, depending on how you look at it, there's also a lot of stakeholders around the community that you need to keep in mind. And so, it is complex. Like for example, one aspect of emergency management is this idea of COOP or business continuity, depending on where you are in government or in private industry. And we're kind of in the middle. We do a little bit of both. We do some business continuity things, and we do some COOP things. And so when I have these conversations, you know, every industry is going to be different. But this is, I think, what's most remarkable is this enormous responsibility that shows up every morning, and you take care of them all day long. And then you send them back every day. And then within that, there's a subset of kids with access and functional needs that are even more vulnerable. And, you know, I recently was helping out at a large technology firm, and they actually, when I signed into the company, they had me identify whether I needed assistance for evacuation if there were an emergency, which I thought was really interesting. Well, we have, I sometimes work with school districts where they have not updated the PEEPs for their student body in some time, or they don't even have them, the personal emergency evacuation plan. Or I'll have a conversation with them saying, okay, your PEEPs are all up to date. Which of your employees have access and functional needs? And they'll say, oh, we only do those for students. I was like, I don't think OSHA feels the same way as you do.
Absolutely. Yeah. So how is this staff member, this faculty member, going to help the student if they don't have their own plan? It's like on the airplane. you know, put your own mask on first before you help somebody else. Absolutely. Wow. Wow.
It's a very complex industry.
I wanted to, so you used a couple of other acronyms. And for the folks who are watching or listening who are not in the industry, you talked about ICS and COOP. So share with folks what those two acronyms mean.
Okay, so ICS, it's not a requirement, but it is the incident command system. It's not a requirement from FEMA, but it is a system that is used by public safety for organizing their response to an event. So today, can I say what day it is today? It's the 27th of March. This will come on in a few weeks, but the we just had the event where the Francis Scott Key Bridge has collapsed in Baltimore, and they the Coast Guard is extremely adept at the use of incident command. They're really innovators in the area, and they're setting up a unified command using this incident command system to organize an exceptionally complex operation, which will potentially take months or years in being in effect. But I also advocate for it with schools of getting organized, like for a medical evacuation of a child who's having a medical event. Let's have an incident commander. Let's bring the PIO in so we get the right information out to the parents, that sort of thing. And the other advantage of using incident command for schools is that they need to interface effectively with public safety when they show up, because almost every event will result in a police or fire or police and fire response. And so they need to know how to handle that. And then the other one was COOP, which is continuity of operations plans, or planning, versus business continuity. And they're slightly different. The big difference being COOP is really more of a government action, and when we assess our services that we need to keep functioning, we think about what are the most critical functions, versus a company which has business impact analysis, where they can quantify, sometimes down to the dollar, the cost of not conducting their day-to-day operations.
Absolutely. Yeah. Again, that's another example of sometimes people pick the binary choice. And honestly, I believe that you really, even in government, need to be able to do both. I mean, there are a lot of local governments right now who have continuity of operations plans and haven't put a cost to it. Because some guy did it 15 years ago, we kind of keep doing it. And if they did put a cost to it, they would find that it's not as efficient as it used to be because things have changed. Or, you know, it doesn't cost near as much as they think. I mean, though government is not really a business, because they're two different things. They really are. One is for profit, the other is for social value. But there are things that can be tracked as to cost. And, you know, so really both. And in a business, you know, if you don't know what your basic operations are to that are really critical, you're not going to make a lot of money because you won't be able to stay in business. And people were probably asking. So I come on here to learn about psychological health and safety. So here's the connection. These systems help people feel better, even in the midst of chaos. In the midst of chaos, it's difficult. You know, we've both been there. You know, so the law enforcement, the fire service, you know, the EMS folks show up. We don't have the emergency. The other people do. And, you know, the more organized we are, the more sometimes the calmer they can be, because it can also be more calming for us. A game we used to play when I first got promoted to a fire officer is this game of how calm can you sound on the radio? Because the more my voice goes up, the quicker I talk, the more stressed I'm making everybody else there. And again, it's not our problem, not really, until we make it ours. I mean, our folks are trained, they're qualified, they've got all this expertise, But when we get so wound up that we, you know, it's back to what you're talking about, the teachers. If they don't feel safe themselves, how are they going to take care of the, you know, the first grader? They're so wound up themselves. And so there's a real connection between having or helping people feel safe and being organized. there's a connection. It takes away some of the stress.
Yeah. One of the examples I give to superintendents is how many people can do your payroll? Because if you want to give people if you want to take away their sense of psychological safety, have the payroll be a day late. So you better have not just your payroll clerk or a couple of payroll clerks. You need to go. That's one of those critical business functions that's directly tied to psychological safety that you have to get right 100% of the time.
Right, right. Yeah, I heard once that people can live in a tent. They really can. They can live, you know, in a lean-to for a while. They really need their ability to be able to make an income. So it's getting, you know, getting business function, getting it to the point to where you can pay people is really super important, because otherwise they can't take care of their flooded house or their lost belongings or what have you if they don't have the ability to access resources. I mean, there are some folks who have, you know, they're fortunate enough to have a lot of excess, but most people don't. I mean, I think I heard that the average person in the United States can't get access to $1,000 for an emergency. And these are the kinds of folks that that you're going to find particularly in public schools. And I think you work mostly with public schools?
I've actually worked with both private schools and public schools. But obviously, in terms of numbers, the numbers are much higher with public schools.
Sure, sure. And again, that the you know, it's not that, you know, it wouldn't matter whether you're a, you know, a really rich kid or a poor kid if there's a hurricane coming, that'd affect everybody the same. But in terms of preparedness, you know, when particularly again in the public school system, you're dealing with folks from every strata of life whose daily existence sometimes might be challenged. That's to include people who are unhoused. I mean, and all of those folks are coming through this system. And so in terms of, from a preparedness perspective, how does the diversity of people that you have to be responsible for, or care for, or plan for, how does that affect your planning?
Well, I think that we need to be we have a focus on equity, and we have to be aware that there are people that are more vulnerable, like what you were talking about. There are people that are going to be more impacted. So one of the things that I do is I volunteer with an organization called Team Rubicon, which is a disaster response agency, which is led by veterans and was established by veterans. And I was in the bayou in Louisiana after a hurricane. And you're right, everyone was impacted the same by the hurricane. Ish, right? But as Team Rubicon uses a framework from the CDC for social vulnerability, and so we try to serve those communities that are most impacted through this social vulnerability index. And as we would drive to work sites, we would go through wealthy white neighborhoods, and their roofs were covered with people re-roofing them. And you would get into a poor neighborhood, primarily persons of color in that neighborhood, and there was nobody working on any of them except for people in gray shirts from Team Rubicon. So it kind of affects everyone the same, but it really doesn't.
Right, right.
That's anecdotal, but I think it's probably pretty accurate. I mean, we're using some science and data to drive that sort of work. And I think that I apply that to schools too. These kids, you know, we have schools where very significant percentage of the kids are have subsidized school lunches. And you can use common sense and data to figure out that we need to help those kids more. We had a number of school districts during COVID that continued to deliver. They actually used their school buses to deliver meals to those kids that were eligible for school lunches, because the schools are where those kids get their nutrition. And so we have really deep responsibility that goes far beyond just, how are your math skills?
Right. So you again, background, expertise, both in the education system and outside. Talk about, not only just the diversity of the people that you serve, but being an educational system itself. What are some things that you see that, that folks may not realize when it comes to preparing for emergencies in a school? I think when we think about preparedness in general, we don't really think about school systems. We think about at least governments and businesses, and kind of forget, as you talked, that a school system, many of them actually are governments on the one hand, but they also provide things that the rest of the government does not, in terms of they have this captive group of people who you picked them up from home. You got to get them home. You're feeding them and almost housing them and caring for them, particularly with some of these after school programs. So just talk about some of the unique aspects of preparedness in a K-12 kind of environment that are unique from some other places.
Well, there's tremendous disparities. I work with some school districts that have larger school districts that have a full-time emergency manager or a full-time emergency management team even. And so they're able to do a great deal because they're not encumbered by the day-to-day requirement to educate kids. Because ultimately, that's what superintendents get hired, because they know how to manage education. And I don't think they get asked a lot during oral board questions for superintendent about how their emergency management skills might be. I routinely work with districts where they don't have anybody, or sometimes a school nurse will take that on. Nurses happen to be very good at emergency management in general, the facilities person, I've been at schools where the closest thing to an emergency manager is really the janitor.
Right.
And so there's a lot of disparity. After COVID, there were a lot of people were feeling like, there were statistical realities that kids had fallen behind academically. And so there's really a push to get caught up academically and getting caught up on your emergency operations plans isn't necessarily a priority, but they realize they know that it's important, but it frequently is not the top priority. And a lot of times they call me when they're having an emergency, and frequently that's too late.
Do you need more psych health and safety in your life? Then head over to the FlourishDX Academy for several free on-demand e-learning courses. If you're an internal professional, follow FlourishDX on Eventbrite to register for any of our free fortnightly interactive webinars. Our flagship professional practice program is also exclusively available for internal professionals. The 12-week course blends theory, applied practice, and interaction with other professionals through live lectures and a monthly community of practice session. Find out more about all these learning opportunities or inquire about a bespoke in-house training at the FlourishDX Academy. www.45003.org. Now, back to this episode.
So, talk to me a little bit more about your thoughts around this whole concept of psychological safety and preparedness, how, in your mind, how they connect and where the intersection is for you.
Well, I've recently read that people really want safety training, security training. They want to receive the training. And I think that the reason is they want to feel competent, because they know that feeling competent in those areas and knowing that their leaders are competent at responding to an emergency will result in an increase in psychological safety for them.
And one of those areas that I spend a lot of time on is in our emergency response protocols. And some of those are better than others, honestly. But I also think that people make an error in the drills versus exercises. And we can conduct drills and become competent without any connection to the underlying event, emotional connection to the underlying event. There's maybe a little bit of testosterone that comes from maybe the military, police, fire side of things, where we think we have to, like, to do an evacuation drill, which is what we do in case of a fire. We never have to tell people that the building's on fire. In fact, we could cue it without a fire alarm. We just want to, when I teach an evacuation, I tell them it is a safe and orderly departure to a planned assembly point. And with kids, it's with a full accountability of all of our students. And we don't need to do that with, we don't need to have flames. I've heard stories of people, and I think everybody in the audience has heard stories of people doing like they'll start a fire. I mean, the worst case scenario is the, that episode of The Office where Dwight Schrute is running around lighting fires and right. It's, Dwight Schrute is probably the ultimate example of a terrible emergency manager, but it's that sort of thing. And so when we use this term of things being done in a trauma-informed way, and in my mind for emergency management, one of those things that we can do is make sure that the workforce that doesn't have to make organizational level decisions, they probably don't need to do a bunch of exercises. They don't need to have, like, we shouldn't have kids in the building when SWAT is doing active shooter response, right? And in fact, every employee that's present in the building, that needs to be a conscious, controlled decision with lots of notice that whether they are going to be in the building or not. And so we don't want to, There is this notion of stress inoculation, but particularly with children, it doesn't work, and with most of our workforce, we just don't need to do that much of it. If they feel competent, we can give them a sense of psychological safety. So, for example, our lockdown response, locks, lights, out of sight. I actually work with a super innovative company. It's called Sammy and Friends. It's a children's story that we read to kids, the teachers read to kids, and we kind of gamify, storify the idea of lockdown, and it's connected to a friendly Sasquatch. It is not connected to, you know, what we as adults know is this terrible reality that there are people that sometimes perpetrate acts of violence within schools. And so I think that making people competent, but also always doing it in a trauma-informed way that we're, and for some people, trauma-informed may not be something that they're necessarily understanding, but in my mind, it's not scaring your workforce, not scaring your customers. And to me, that is, I can get people out of the building. I can get people locked down. I can secure the perimeter. I can put them into secure without ever putting it into the context of what that is.
Right. Yeah, that I can't say I've heard it described in the way that you just described it, but it makes a lot of sense. It's, you know, it's important to consider how this thing that may ultimately help people, but will it traumatize them in the meantime? and balancing that and making sure that, you know, you don't do that. You know, it is, you know, as I mentioned in the opening, since 1999, we have a generation of people. And many of these people are now in their, you know, what, early, mid to late 30s now, who've kind of experienced this, you know, mid to late 30s, even in their 40s, but they experience all this trauma of Columbine and 9/11 and the economic downturn. And then we wonder why so many people in our society are struggling with their mental health now. It's because they've been traumatized over and over. And again, not, this isn't to blame educators and to blame local responders, because at the time, that's all they knew to do. As you mentioned, nobody gets hired to be a superintendent because they're an emergency manager. That's they don't know. They really don't. And it's not that they have poor intent, but the word that you use that I really, and I love hearing that word, it's about competence. People, you can't expect people to be competent in an area that they've never been exposed to, they don't have access to any information. They're kind of making it up. They're doing the best that they can. And, you know, what folks like you do is help people, like, okay, look, I know that seems like that's a really big deal, but there's a way to take care of that big deal and not traumatize everybody in the process. That's really, really very, very important, because these traumas follow people. They do.
And ultimately, you're setting up either your employees or your student body to be more prone to dysregulation in a crisis if you include trauma in the drill.
Wow. Yeah, so that whole idea about, you know, hey, we got to get a bunch of people out there and moulage them up and make it look horrible. Maybe not. Maybe that's not a good idea for a bunch of fourth graders.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Now, I do have a school district here that has a community emergency response team training that they do. They have kids that volunteer. Then they, you know, they're high school kids. So they moulage them up, but they're kids that volunteered and they prepared for it. And they actually became competent at some higher level, like stop the bleed kind of skills. Yeah, exactly. You can do it with kids, but you can't do it with fourth graders. And you can't do it with the whole student body. I've had examples of districts that have done these like drills, which with kind of like you're talking about, with a lot of emotional content, maybe some moulage, that sort of thing, where they have had they've lost employees, they've had people resign, and the cost of an employee. It's not really about psychological safety, but they took away the psychological safety of that employee to such an extent that they could not come back to work.
Right. Well, you've just described exposure to a psychosocial hazard. Again, anything, you know, anything that is perceived or experienced by me as a threat to me that causes me to act in a different way is a psychosocial hazard. And it's just different. It depends on my age. It depends on my experience. It depends on my exposure to other things. There's all kinds of factors. And there's often no way to know in advance, particularly without asking. We can make some assumptions about, again, third and fourth graders, because their brain just isn't developed enough to be able to process all this stuff. But even for the adults, that's why, again, just something that, you know, is really important that you said is, it's about, you know, having that conversation in advance. They're just like I would say that there's no reason for people to get physically injured during training. There's no reason for people to get emotionally injured during training either. There's just no reason for that. It's about the conversation. Here's what we're trying to achieve. Here's some of the things that we're going to do. And again, there are circumstances where, you know, this is going to be so traumatic but we should have prepped you for that. You don't go from zero to full out trauma. You know, you didn't get involved in Team Rubicon as a brand new police officer. You already had enough background, you know, or, you know, fresh into the military. People need to have the opportunity to be able to get centered and understand what they're in. And I really would say that this is where orientations are really so important before people get exposed. That it's again, like any hazard, to the extent we can let people know in advance, this is what this is going to be like. They might sound like disclaimers, but they're more than disclaimers. They're to get people prepared and to make sure that this is something that you're ready to do. Because if you're not, we need to find someone who won't be traumatized by this and not force people to go like, we got to get Dan in there. That's going to make him tough. No, it's going to traumatize him, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think a principle of trauma-informed practices is building in choice. And we should do that for our employees. We should do that for our students. And with emergency management, we can build in choice. And that's that conversation that we have where we let the person make the decision whether they're going to be involved or not. And now we have applied a trauma-informed practice. And when you do use trauma-informed practices, I think that the chances of achieving psychological safety are much higher.
Right. So do you see, are you seeing or hearing or having more conversation about trauma-informed practices and about psychological health and safety in general in the emergency management community?
Yeah, I think so to some extent. I know that, for example, I'm in Oregon, and the Oregon Police Academy is actually integrating trauma-informed practices into training at the basic police academy. So I think it's becoming more common. Having done 28 years of trauma-filled, not trauma-informed service, I think that it's really important. I don't know that I can assess the amount of penetration of these practices, but it's so important that we do it, that it's worth doing. And that's one of the reasons that I'm involved with Sammy and Friends, is because that K-2 where we focus on with this program, those kids are so vulnerable, and they're at such a critical developmental stage that we cannot be careless with those that have been entrusted to us.
Yeah, you make me think that effort is in and of itself a kind of a mitigation strategy for long-term trauma. There's, and you've probably heard of this thing called, ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences. And wouldn't it be a shame if one of those experiences is actually at school? And I think back over, over my life, there are a couple that actually happened at school, because at the time the school wasn't really paying attention. I mean, an example is that I haven't heard of any school district recently that wouldn't tell children that bullying is a bad thing. I'm not saying they prevent it all, because they, it's kind of difficult, but it's pretty clear, and it's been that way for the last probably 15 or 20 years, that kids have been told that bullying it's not a good thing. It's not just the way it should be, and report it to an adult and all that type of thing. Where, again, when I can still remember, in the second grade, the kid who bullied me. And I'm not the only person, in my generation who can remember that kid. But at the time, that was also normal. That's just what happened. And there really wasn't the opportunity, or there wasn't the practice to be able to address it. So as you're talking, you're causing me to think that these trauma-informed practices that you're taking into K through, kindergarten through first or second or third grade, is setting these kids up with the opportunity in the future to not be as traumatized as they would be otherwise.
I agree.
Which is a wonderful thing. And that's going to bear fruit, in terms of, the mental health kinds of challenges they have as they get older, So, wow. These are some of the things that you're sharing. Okay, I went to school. I've done a little bit of emergency management here and there, but I can't say that I've really heard them you know, kind of tied together in this way. And it's actually encouraging. It's encouraging that there are folks as yourself, such as yourself, that are out there having these conversations with people about the importance of not just being prepared for, you know, Mother Nature and Father Time and all the physical things that could happen, but the emotional things as well. And they're both important. They really are. They really are. So as we start to wrap the conversation, so let's say we have folks that they may be involved in education. They may have some concern about what's going on in the schools where their kids go. Where should they start? So if there's an organization out there, they know they need to do something. They haven't taken the kind of steps that, you know, the groups that you're involved with have taken. Where should they start?
Well, I think that at an organizational level, the U.S. Department of Education has an emergency management function. It's called REMS. REMS TA, and I should probably know what that acronym. I hate knowing acronyms or using acronyms that I don't know the actual meaning of it. Readiness and Emergency Management for Schools. So they have support, they have training. It's all similar and completely entangled with FEMA's approach. And FEMA has the Emergency Management Institute. And so I think that you start doing some research, you start learning some principles. I was just in a meeting with firefighters and police and talking about what we should give kids that are interested in public safety. And we all agree that everyone should have ICS 100, 200, 700, and 800, which you're right. Smiling because,
yeah,
which is kind of the fundamentals of what does an emergency look like? How do we organize for it? And it's all free. You just go on the FEMA website. If you get your Google on, it will get you where you need to be. And so people need to have like a basic understanding of emergency management. And then things will come you'll become aware if you start taking some of these classes. Ideally, you do some in-person kind of training in emergency management. I have sponsored trainings by a variety of federally funded organizations that support schools. And then I think the other part is that regardless of how people feel politically about should there be police in the schools, should there not be police in the schools, whatever, there is a necessity to build relationships between schools, typically your county emergency management function, or if you're in a big city, maybe city emergency management, your fire service and police. And that requires some effort. There is a district, one of the districts I work with, they do a breakfast. They spend the money to put on some good victuals, and they do put on some good breakfast because all public safety will come for free food. And they fill the room with educators, police, fire, EMS, and bring them together. They do some little tabletop exercises on a regular basis, but they're building this relationship so that when there's a fire in the school, there's a medical emergency in the school, there's an intruder in the school, whatever that emergency is, that it's not your first time ever having a person in uniform in the school. And I think that builds psychological safety because we're kind of decoupling that. Some people have some adverse childhood experiences or adverse adult experiences where a person in uniform maybe isn't helping them the way they would like to help them. But if you can decouple that and make it like, you know, even with firefighters, like you don't want the fire marshal who's there to write you for a ticket for having an electric heater under your desk to be your idea of what firefighters are. you know, let them use your facility for some training, maybe have them come in and do some firefighters doing some training on use of the AEDs or maybe traumatic bleeding control protocols or that sort of thing. So you're just building these relationships. And that, to me, that is builds psychological safety, improves the quality of the response from public safety. We spend an enormous amount of money in this country on public safety. If you don't have a relationship with them and you're going to be a user of their services, you're not being a very, you're not expending your money in a particularly wise way.
Absolutely.
I heard once that great teams don't meet in the huddle. And the other is relationships are primary and all else is derivative. And, you know, that lack of relationship often is one of the sources of stress because I don't know you. I'm not comfortable with you. I've not seen you before. I don't really know how to relate to you. And the opportunities that people take, particularly in and around our children, to have strong relationships becomes a model for children as well about how relationships are built. And, you know, even, uniforms aren't scary. They don't have to be scary. And if we can, you know, invest some time in those kinds of conversations early, again, I think as a society, we end up with with a great return down the road. So, Dan, thanks very much for this very informative conversation around the connections between, you know, psychological health and safety and emergency preparedness and education. It's this very interesting web of connections. And just before we go, if folks want to, you know, reach out to you, find out more about some of the things that you're doing, what's the best way to do that?
Can you put my email in the show notes as well, but it's mazamaconsulting@gmail.com. And I'll give you my info, and I'll also give you the information for Sammy and Friends to put in your show notes as well, because I think it's an important resource that people need to be aware of.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, yeah, again, certainly appreciate your time and the wisdom that you've shared with me and those who have been hanging out with us for the last almost an hour. So if you're watching this episode on the Flourish DX YouTube page, please do like, subscribe, and share. Love to have this information out to others who may not have been able to participate. If you're watching or listening to the podcast for the first time, welcome. I hope that something you've heard or something you've seen will cause you to come back in the future. Previous episodes of the podcast can be found at psychhealthandsafetyusa.com. And please do become a part of what we call the Psych Health and Safety USA movement by connecting to us on LinkedIn. So until the next time that we get the opportunity to share, please do take care of yourself, and we'll look forward to the next opportunity on the next episode of the Psych Health and Safety USA podcast. Thanks very much. Tune in each Friday for new episodes of the Psych Health and Safety USA podcast. If you have a story or know of one that needs to be told, reach out to us on LinkedIn or send an email to david@id2-solutions.com or go to the Flourish DX website at flourishdx.com. We'll see you next time.